Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this lecture in the Senate Department's occasional lecture series. I apologise once again for being in this terrible venue, but here we are. We've been bumped out of a committee room, so here we are. Earlier this week, a Senate committee presented a report on the question of compensation for the stolen generation. This is only the most recent report on a subject that keeps on recurring in Australian public administration and legislative policy, the suggestion that there should be special legislative schemes of compensation for one sort or another. Back in 1974, the then Whitlam government proposed a grand national compensation scheme to compensate everybody for everything, I think it was, which sank in a Senate committee because of the complexities involved in it. So it's a constantly recurring theme of public policy in Australia, and we haven't heard the last of it by any means. But it just so happens we have here today the man who administered perhaps the biggest of these statutory compensation schemes, the compensation scheme for the victims of the families of the victims of the 9/11 disaster. And he administered that scheme, and he wrote a book about it later, which is an amazing book to read. I commend it to you. And we're very fortunate to have him here today to share his experience with us. Please welcome Kenneth Feinberg.
Thank you very much. It is a real honour for me to be here, and I want to thank Mr. Evans for inviting me and giving me the opportunity to spend a few minutes to discuss the compensation of victims of disaster, particularly 9/11. Now, Mr. Evans mentions my book, and he says it's a good read. Now, you may have trouble finding that book at Barnes & Noble or a bookstore, What is Life Worth? But don't worry. If you can't find that book, just find a way through Mr. Evans or whatever to email me. My supply of my book is virtually inexhaustible. And I'll make sure I can get you a copy, so don't worry if you can't find the book. My subject today, and I'm enormously grateful to Mr. Evans for inviting me to Australia. I have not been to Australia before, and I've spent a week at Australian National University Law School, meeting with faculty and students. I spent a couple of days in Sydney, that incredible opera house in Sydney, and have walked across the bridge in Sydney, had to do that. And I've spent the last 4 days here in Canberra meeting with parliamentary officials and the leader of the opposition and other people. And it's just been a wonderful, unfortunately, a whirlwind visit. I return to the United States tomorrow, but it's a long way from the United States here in Australia. But I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and this is the capstone and a wonderful, gracious invitation from Mr. Evans and the Parliament to come here and chat. Compensating victims of disaster. It really should say, Is it sound public policy to do so? Now, let me start off by reminding everybody, Mr. Evans is correct. There's never been anything quite like the 9/11 Victim Compensation Fund. Let's start there and talk about the implications of that fund and how it might apply or not apply elsewhere in the United States, Australia, or any other country. 11 days after 9/11, Congress passed a law in the United States signed by President Bush. And the law was very simple. It said, anybody who lost a loved one on 9/11, World Trade Center, airplanes, Pentagon, or anybody who was physically injured as a result of the attacks on 9/11 could voluntarily waive their right to litigate. Don't go to court. Don't sue the airlines. Don't sue the World Trade Center. Don't sue the manufacturer of the airplanes. Don't bring a lawsuit. Instead, at your option, come into a very generous, publicly funded compensation system. You don't have to. You can go file a lawsuit if you want. But why not instead come into a compensation fund funded entirely by the taxpayer and be compensated very, very generously in amounts unprecedented in American history, or as far as I can tell, unprecedented anywhere? That's all that was what the law said. Now, over the life of the fund, which lasted 33 months, and the law also said, Congress asks the Attorney General of the United States and the President to designate one person to design the program, implement it, and administer it. And the President asked me to do it. And I did it for 33 months. If statistics are any indication, the fund was a clear, unqualified success. 97% of all eligible claimants entered the fund voluntarily. 2,980 dead family members entered the fund. 2,400 physically injured victims of 9/11 entered the fund. Only 94 people decided not to come into the fund and instead decided to litigate in court. Of those 94, here it is 7 years later or so, 90 have settled. So today there are only 4 people, victims of 9/11, still litigating. There were 7 people who did nothing. They never entered the fund. They never filed a lawsuit. Paralyzed by grief, unable to get out of bed, they allowed the fund time limits to expire and never did anything. I visited some of them. I saw one woman. I said, Mrs. Jones, you have 6 weeks to file before the fund expires. I'll help you fill out the application. Mr. Feinberg, I lost my son. Go away. I said, just sign it. You're going to get about $2 million tax-free. It won't bring my son back. Go away. And she never filed. 7 people never filed or never opted to file a lawsuit. So in grief were they were unable to do either. Everybody else came into the fund or a few people decided to sue. Now, how much money, publicly funded, was expended? A little over $7 billion. Billion. The average award for a death claim, a little over $2 million tax-free. The average award for a physical injury claim, a little over $400,000 tax-free. The awards ranged from $500 that was awarded to an individual who broke her finger at the World Trade Center, all the way to $8.1 million that was awarded a woman who survived 9/11 and came to see me with third-degree burns over 85% of her body. That was the range of awards. There were about 7,300 claims that were filed, and we found eligible about 5,300 people dead and physically injured. Now, the statute creating the fund, compensating the victims of this unique disaster, was extremely problematic. For example, the statute required that I award different amounts to every claimant. Now, that made sense because, remember, the Congress was trying to divert people out of litigation. Well, if you want to entice people out of litigation, you've got to give more money to the stockbroker, the bond trader, and the banker than the waiter, the busboy, the cop, the fireman, the soldier. In other words, By tying the program to the American litigation tort system, it guaranteed that everybody would get a different amount of money in order to convince people, don't sue. That decision of Congress to require one person, me, to evaluate every claim and give everybody a different amount of money was extremely problematic and very, very divisive. Mr. Feinberg, my husband died a fireman at the World Trade Center, a hero. You're giving me $1 million less than the banker's widow who worked for Enron. That doesn't sound very fair to me. Am I missing something? Why are you demeaning the memory of my husband? Well, ma'am, I'm not demeaning the memory. I'm not looking at the moral intrinsic worth of anybody. I'm simply calculating awards based on economic circumstances. Blah, blah, blah. That didn't sit well, you see, with people in grief. Now, judges and juries do it every day in America. Compensation is the barometer used in compensating victims of loss. If you're hitting if you get killed in an automobile accident, if you fall off a ladder, if you take a drug that doesn't work properly, if you breathe asbestos, compensation, dollars, is a surrogate for loss, for damage. You try telling that to 5,300 grieving people, that everybody's going to get a different amount of money. And it's a problem. Now, I'm asked all the time, what were the most difficult problems you confronted, Ken, in designing and administering the program? Well, the first problem was the one I've just explained. I was required by law to tell every single claimant that everybody, your next-door neighbor's getting a different amount of money. Not only was it a problem, but it was a problem administering a program like that. If you're going to give everybody a different amount of money, it's based on what the victim would have earned over a work life but for 9/11. What would the banker have made? What would the soldier have made? What would the fireman have made? What would the secretary have made if they had continued to work? Mr. Feinberg, you ought to calculate based on the future. Well, you try calculating based on assumptions about what people would have done. Mr. Feinberg, I lost my son. He was a soldier at the Pentagon, but he was going to retire from the Pentagon in 2 years and then get a very good consulting practice and work as a private consultant for the Department of Defense. How do I know that? That's what you say. How do I look into a murky crystal ball and try and calculate the future? A big, big problem. Mr. Feinberg, I lost my daughter. She was a first-year law associate. She had just graduated law school and was working for a law firm in the World Trade Center, and she was killed. But when you calculate the loss, don't you rely on her first-year salary? She was going to be at that law firm for 6 years and then become a partner in the law firm. And in the seventh year, they were going to change the name of the firm to add her name. Well, Mrs. Jones, you don't know that your daughter was going to... Don't tell me about my daughter. Did you ever meet her? Did you ever know her? No. Well, how dare you? You will listen to what I say. It is not speculation. I know. Well, it was very, very difficult, you see. So that was problem number one. Problem number one. Problem number two. The law required me to also award, in addition to economic loss, pain and suffering, emotional distress. Well, I said at the outset, I am not Solomon, and I am not going to calibrate different degrees of emotional distress. Everybody who died had pain and emotional distress. Everybody gets the same. $250,000 for the death of the victim, plus $100,000 for each surviving spouse or dependent. That's it for non-economic loss, for pain and suffering. Very controversial. Mr. Feinberg, if I go to court, I'll get $2 million for pain and suffering. You will? You better be careful. If you go to court, you may get nothing. You may get nothing in court. That was the second problem. Then there was the third problem Congress created in its infinite wisdom. After you calculate the awards, you must deduct any money that the victim got from collateral sources, like life insurance, like workers' compensation benefits, like state victim crime payments. Those must be deducted before you cut the check. Mr. Feinberg, I don't get it. I was going to get $3 million from your fund, but you're deducting $1 million because my wife had life insurance. So you're only going to give me $2 million. My next door neighbor's getting $3 million because instead of buying life insurance, they went to Las Vegas and gambled it away. You're penalizing me for sound financial planning. I don't get it. I don't get it. Well, ma'am, the law requires blah, 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 blah. The law requires. Talk about horizontal inequity. It was a serious problem. Problem number four. The law made no distinction between American citizens and other people. They were all eligible. Six Australians got paid under the 9/11 fund. Six Australians died in New York City or the Pentagon or on the airplanes. They were all eligible. But I met in London with families from 65 foreign countries. I'm here to tell you, you're all eligible. Any questions? Up go the hands. Do we have to give up our citizenship to get the money? No. Do we have to surrender our passports? No. Do we have to come to the United States to get the money? No. Do we get the money in local currency or dollars? You get the money in dollars. We'll think about it. CIA. This guy must be from the CIA. You mean to tell us that your government is going to give us over $2 million for the death of our daughter? That's right. No strings? That's right. We'll think about it. Don't call us. We'll call you. Now, eventually, they all came into the fund, but trying to convince people that I'm here to give you money raise, shall we say, skepticism about the motives of the United States. Now, that was a problem. Then there was this problem. 11 people died on 9/11 in the World Trade Center who were undocumented workers, illegal immigrants. They were working illegally in the World Trade Center. Their wives and children were all eligible. I went up to New York, to the Bronx, to the Spanish community. I translated the 9/11 application into Spanish. I translated the immigration rules into Spanish. And I met with the families up there, with the wives of the dead. Mrs. Dominguez, you're from the Dominican Republic. Your husband was working illegally. It doesn't matter. I'm here to give you and your three children compensation. Any questions? Will we be deported? No. In fact, the United States will give you a green card allowing you to seek permanent employment. Will I be put in jail? No. Will you take my children away? No. Will I be deported to the Dominican Republic? I felt like saying, Mrs. Dominguez, you'll be the richest person in the Dominican Republic with this money. Now, you can't say that. But the frustration, you see, in getting people to accept this gratis, eventually they all took the money. They saw there was no hidden agenda. Then by far the worst problem, by far the biggest challenge, not even close, kept me up 3 a.m. at night, We decided wisely any eligible claimant who so desired could have the opportunity for an individual hearing with me in confidence under oath to state whatever anybody wanted to tell me. You didn't have to. Half the people didn't ask for a hearing. But the other half asked for permission, granted, to come and see me and to vent about life's unfairness, you see. That was the biggest problem, the impact on my psyche, listening to over 1,000 people individually, like a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, come to me with their tales of woe. Mr. Feinberg, thank you for seeing me. I'd like to start off my hearing. I was married to my wife for 25 years, and I'd like to start off the hearing by playing you a videotape of our wedding 25 years ago. I want you to see what a wonderful woman she was in happier times. Mr. Feinberg, I'm here to tell you that my wife is dead, and I want to play for you the audio tape of her calling me trapped from the 103rd floor of the World Trade Center, saying goodbye and screaming that I should take care of our children. Mr. Jones, you don't have to play that. That won't have any bearing on... I want you to listen to what those murderers did to my wonderful wife. Play the tape. People would come with diplomas, ribbons, medals, certificates of good conduct, reference letters, all attempting to memorialize, validate a lost loved one. And the stories I heard. Mr. Feinberg, I'm 24 years old. I'm sorry about I'm sobbing and I'm my composure. But I want you to know I'm 24 years old, Mr. Feinberg, and I lost my husband. He was a fireman at the World Trade Center, and he left me with our two children, 6 and 4. And my husband's gone, and I want the money, and I want it in 30 days. Mrs. Jones, we have to go through procedures here and everything. Why do you need the money so quickly? Why? I'll tell you why. I have terminal cancer. I have 8 weeks to live. My husband was going to survive me and take care of our two little children. Now they're going to be orphans. Now I need that money quickly while I still have all my faculties to set up a fund for them because I'm gone. 7 weeks later, we went to her funeral. Now, you can't think up stories like this, you see. A 70-year-old man comes to see me, crying. Mr. Feinberg, I lost my son at the Pentagon on 9/11. When the plane hit, he got out of the Pentagon. He escaped. He thought his sister was trapped. He went back in to look for her. She had got out a side door. He died looking for her. There is no God, Mr. Feinberg, that would allow this to happen. How could this be allowed to happen? A lady comes to see me, crying. I lost my husband at the World Trade Center. He was a fireman. He brought 30 people to safety from the World Trade Center, and the battalion chief said, "Stay here, too dangerous." He said, "Chief, I've never disobeyed you, but I see 10 people trapped in Tower 1. I'm going to go rescue them and bring them back." And then this woman, crying, says to me, "Mr. Feinberg, he died while he was running across the World Trade Center plaza. He was killed when somebody jumped to their death from the 103rd floor and hit him. Like a missile. They both died." There is no God, Mr. Feinberg. Now, all of the stories I heard varied, every one, but there was one that kept me up at 3 a.m. I didn't know what to do. A lady comes to see me. "Mr. Feinberg, I lost my husband. I'm 24 years old. I lost my husband at the World Trade Center. He was a fireman, and he was Mr. Mom." Mr. Mom, every day that he wasn't at that firehouse, he was home teaching our six-year-old how to play baseball, teaching our four-year-old how to read, reading a bedtime story to the two-year-old. He was Mr. Mom. What a cook. He cooked all our meals. He was the gardener around the house. He was my right arm, and I'll never be the same. No matter how much money you give me, Mr. Feinberg, I'd trade it all tomorrow just to have my husband back. The kids are without a father. I am only living for my three kids. I will never be the same. I've lost my best friend. She leaves. The next day, I get a telephone call from a lawyer in New York City. Mr. Feinberg, did you meet yesterday with Mrs. Jones with the three kids? Yeah. And Mr. Mom? Yeah. Now look, Mr. Feinberg, I'm not trying to cause you any trouble. But I want you to know, she doesn't know that Mr. Mom has two other kids by his girlfriend in Queens, 5 and 3. Now, I'm calling to tell you this because when you cut your check, there's not three children who survive, there's five. And I want you to know that I represent the girlfriend as guardian of these two other kids. I just want you, I'm sure you'll do the right thing. Click. Now, do you tell her about these two other kids? Do you tell her, look, I'm cutting checks because there's five children, not three? Well, I never told her. I don't know the fact. Who am I to prick the bubble this woman has of her husband, the memory of what she... I don't know the facts. I don't know the circumstances. I'm just trying to do this job and get this money out. We cut one check to the wife and the three kids, and then we cut a separate check, in confidence, to the girlfriend as guardian of the two kids. Now, I'm sure it's 7 years later that they know, but I didn't feel, tossing and turning, that it was appropriate for me to disclose all of this information to this woman who has a memory of her husband. I don't know. There are people in this audience who I'm sure would have done it differently. But that was the toughest part of the job, you see, the hearings. People didn't come to these hearings to talk about money. People came to these hearings to vent about life's unfairness, you see. And that was the most difficult part of the job. But the fun worked. It worked. As the date approached for the statutory expiration of the program, the fund by statute ended December 22nd, 2003. If you didn't file a claim by that date, nothing I can do. Two-thirds of all the applications were filed in the last 6 months as the statutory deadline approached. Senator Kennedy came to me and said, Ken, shouldn't we extend the deadline to give people more time to file? Don't you dare. If you extend that deadline, people will procrastinate. People will wait. People will hem and haw. People will think it over. People won't do it. Leave the date. And sure enough, the last couple of weeks, people were throwing applications over the transom. We kept our offices open till midnight. The flood of applications that came in. So that's how the program worked. And now we go from that. I still have, Mr. Evans is a taskmaster, but I still have 15 minutes. We now go to the next question, which is very important here in Australia and every other democracy. Okay, that's the fund. Now let's ask the following questions. One, why did the fund work so well? What was it about the fund that got 97% of the people to come in? And not only that, how did you even get Congress to do a fund? A lesson for a lot of people. One, there was tremendous bipartisan political support for the 9/11 fund. It was supported by Republicans, Democrats, liberals, conservatives, President Bush over here, Senator Kennedy over here. It was supported by virtually politicians across the board. Two, very generous. Very generous. $2 million per claim on average. No appropriation by Congress. We hereby authorize the 9/11 fund. Whatever it's going to cost, let Feinberg figure it out. We do not authorize, we do not appropriate one nickel. Thank goodness. Can you imagine if I had to take from Peter to pay Paul? Instead, Congress, in its wisdom, whatever Feinberg says, just authorize it. It'll be paid out of petty cash from the U.S. Treasury. No appropriation. That helped. That helped. If I needed more money, I printed it, basically. That helped. $7 billion is a pretty attractive program. Three, the absolute support of the American people, the press, everybody, editorials, wonderful, keep up the good work, get it done, what a task, good work. Don't falter. We're behind you. I still walk down airport corridors. Somebody comes up to me and says, aren't you the guy that did the 9/11 fund? I get ready to duck. Wonderful. Thank you for what you did for the country. You've got to have a political wave of support to do compensation funds that will work. And another very interesting thing about the 9/11 fund. Very interesting. The United States government agreed to this fund without ever apologizing for anything. To this day, the United States government has never apologized for 9/11. It was a sneak attack by foreign terrorists. What are we apologizing for? No apology. Compensation? Yes. We'll show our solidarity with the victims. We're a compassionate nation. Pay, but don't ask for an apology. We didn't do anything wrong. There'll be no apology, and yet we'll pay $7 billion. Rather unique. Now, the 9/11 Fund raises some very interesting questions. One, was it a good idea? Was it sound public policy? I think the 9/11 Fund, fabulous idea. It was the right thing to do at the time. It was a unique response to an unprecedented historical tragedy in America, rivaled only by the American Civil War, Pearl Harbor, and the assassination of President Kennedy. So the idea of a fund to not only divert people out of the tort system so they won't sue the airlines, but also in its generosity to demonstrate the social cohesiveness, the national solidarity of the American people towards not only American victims but foreign victims from Australia and everywhere else. Fabulous idea, and it exhibited, I think, the best of the American character and the American heritage. So my answer to question number one is it was a wonderful idea. But I must tell you, in all honesty, here today, it is a very, very close question. A very close question. You should read some of the emails that I received when I was administering the fund. Dear Mr. Feinberg, my daughter died in the Oklahoma City bombing. Where's my check? Dear Mr. Feinberg, my son was on the USS Cole in Yemen when he died when there was a suicide attack on the Cole. How come I'm not eligible for your fund? Dear Mr. Feinberg, my brother died in the African embassy bombings in Kenya. How come I'm not eligible for your fund? Dear Mr. Feinberg, my daughter died in the basement of the World Trade Center in the 1993 terrorist attacks committed by the very same people. Where's my check? Not just terrorists. Not just terrorism. Dear Mr. Feinberg, I don't get it. Last year, my wife saved three little girls from drowning in the Mississippi River, and then she drowned a hero. Where's my check? How do you justify, in a democracy, carving out for very special treatment, unbelievable financial generosity, only a very few people who are the victims of life's misfortune? And all these other people, through no fault of their own, they have been thrown a bad curveball. They get nothing. It's very, very difficult, you see, as a philosophic matter, to say, these people are entitled to $2 million each, you, nothing. It's tough. Now, I think it can be justified, and I told you, the 9/11 fund was unique. It can be justified not from the perspective of the victims, but from the perspective of the American people. They wanted to do it, to exhibit to the world post 9/11 the solidarity and support of America for the victims all over the world. So I think from the nation's perspective, it was the right thing to do. But it is a very close question. Second, is it a precedent? Will it be replicated? Will Congress do it again? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. This program, the 9/11 Fund, was a unique response to an unprecedented historical event. Congress has no interest in doing this again. In fact, after Hurricane Katrina, there were 1,000 people who died in New Orleans. One of the worst national catastrophes in American history, there wasn't the slightest interest in creating a 9/11 fund for the victims of Katrina. No. The 9/11 fund stands alone and should not be seen as a precedent for anything. It should be looked on as a historical aberration from the norm. Third, if Congress decides to do it again, or if any other country decides to set up such a fund, do you think it's a good idea to give people a different amount of money? No, I do not. If you're going to use public money and you're going to compensate death, give everybody the same amount. Don't make distinctions which just fuel disagreement. If you're going to do it, whether you're the waiter or the soldier or the cop or the banker, all life is worth the same when it comes to public compensation. Congress would have been much better off not tying the fund to the tort system and instead saying everybody gets $250,000 or whatever it is. Would have made my job a lot easier. So if it's done again, I suggest that everybody get the same amount. Finally, did it make any difference that the 9/11 fund did not have with it an apology? Yes, it did. It would have been much easier when I held these hearings for the family members to know that the government was not only giving them the compensation, but was formally and officially sorry for what happened. It just made my job more difficult, the absence of an apology. Are there precedents in American history for an apology coupled with payment? Yes, one that I'm aware of. You'll recall that right after Pearl Harbor in 1941, the United States government compelled relocation of American citizens of Japanese descent from California, too close to Pearl Harbor, to Arizona and New Mexico. They were forced to leave their homes and be relocated in camps in Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. 40 years later, President Reagan and the Congress passed a law. And the law said, to all descendants of Japanese American citizens who were forcefully relocated after Pearl Harbor, we hereby apologize. And we will give each descendant in a family $20,000 as a token of our apology. And President Reagan signed that law. I don't know of another situation in American history where the United States government formally apologized for anything. It hasn't apologized formally for slavery. It hasn't apologized formally to Native Americans. The Japanese situation was a unique situation where President Reagan went along with the Congress. We apologize, and here is a payment. But it again raises this whole question of carving out in a democracy special treatment while others are not eligible. And that's why I get back to my final point, which was my first point, which is you better have the political will not to make compensation for disasters in a democracy a political football. It better be apolitical. It better be bipartisan. It better have the solidarity of its citizenry, as 9/11 and Japanese compensation did. Otherwise, it won't work. And if you're going to compensate for a disaster or historical trauma, you better in advance answer the following basic fundamental questions. One, who's eligible and who isn't eligible? Two, how much are we going to pay these people? Are we going to pay them dollars or money? Or are we going to give them health care or social services? Or what exactly is the compensation, in quotes, that's going to be provided? Three, who's paying for this? The American taxpayer put up $7 billion to pay 9/11 victims. And four, what procedural rights are people going to have to file with the fund? You're going to give them a hearing. Are you going to let them go to court if they don't like the award? A terrible idea. What exactly is the process you're going to create? Unless you deal with all these issues and have the political will to do it, take on some other social goal, because it's just too complicated, too political, too divisive, and lacking the type of bipartisanship that you need. America did it. They did it once for 9/11. They did it for the Japanese American citizens, so they did it twice in 200 and some odd years. It is not much of a precedent for anything. Now I'm perfectly on time. Harry is not throwing me out of the parliament. And you can see the relevance of all this, Congress to parliament. It was Congress that did this. It was Congress that considered it. Not the executive branch, not the courts. It was the elected representatives, like a parliament here in Australia. Debated it, decided to do it without objection. And there we are. Okay, we have 15 minutes, and I was promised that if I came 10,000 miles, there would be excellent questions from a very sophisticated crowd. So we have 15 minutes under Harry's schedule, and I throw it open.
Could I ask any questioners to make their way to the microphones, if they possibly can, so we can record the questions? Can I fit in a brief question while our questions go? How many staff did you have to?
How many staff? I worked pro bono without compensation. You couldn't get paid for this job. I wouldn't, I mean, if they offered, I had no, it would have been inappropriate. I had 18 lawyers on my staff, and then PricewaterhouseCoopers staffed 12 offices, opening thousands of envelopes, calculations. They had about 450 people involved.
Right.
So, now,
well,
Harry goes, huh, let me tell you something. We administered the 9/11 fund at a cost, Pricewaterhouse had a contract, $94 million. We dispensed over $7 billion. That's less than 3% overhead. You show me a federal government program anywhere that did it that cheaply. Yes, sir.
Now well,
oh, I'm sorry.
We have a senator over here. Preference for senators. A distinguished senator, too. Sound.
Go ahead. Thank you very much for that. Very interesting. You may probably be aware of the issue of the stolen generations here in Australia, and I think there's lots of lessons you can take from what you've said. Every situation is different, so there's not far from perfect parallels. But I guess probably as an open-ended question, do you have any comments on that as a general issue here on that in regards to appropriate mechanism for compensation? We have actually done that in one state here in Tasmania, but there is bipartisanship on that. In terms of a national approach, it's bipartisanly opposed to it. So in one sense, it sounds totally unsuited. And I guess I'm interested in your flow-on comment about it doesn't just have to be a specific sum of money, whether other mechanisms, other types of services targeted at a specific group is a valid mechanism.
I think, far be it from an American to comment on stolen generations. I don't know enough about it other than this report that was issued. But it's sort of my blueprint applies. Is there the political will to provide special compensation, either cash or services, to a select group of people? Do you have that political will to do so? If you do, then you've got to ask yourself, stolen generations, who's eligible? I had a terrible problem in the 9/11 fund deciding who was eligible because the United States Congress didn't tell me in the statute who's eligible. I lost my sister in the World Trade Center. When you cut your check, make sure you don't give any money to her brother. She hated her brother. Mr. Feinberg, I was the fiancé of the victim. We were going to be married on September 12th. I should be treated like a spouse. Biological parents of the victim, what do you say to that? That marriage was never going to take place. My son called me and said, I'm calling the whole thing off. Stolen generations, like a lot of, you know, proposed ideas for compensation, who exactly is eligible? How do you define eligibility? What's the nature of the compensation? Are you going to give eligible claimants a check? Like Japanese Americans who are relocated, will give a family $20,000, divide it up any way you want. Who's going to pay for it? Is it the Australian taxpayer? Or are there companies or churches or others who bear some responsibility who should contribute to any fund? I haven't got the foggiest idea as to the answers to those questions. But when you discuss the possibility, and from what I've read, it sounds like a terrible tragedy. But when you discuss the actual, okay, now let's figure out how we might do it. Well, the 9/11 offers some interesting elements. But based on the local circumstances here in Australia, those who want some sort of plan would be well advised in advance to figure out answers to these elements that are necessary if the program isn't to be perceived as some sort of runaway program or without boundaries carved out for just a very few people. Those are the issues. I had the same issues. I hope that's a little bit helpful, maybe that much helpful.
Now, the gentleman second in the row actually got the call first there, so if I go to him, he caught my eye first.
I'm speaking as a voter, not a senator. Therefore, in our system, the voter is before the senator.
Is this going to be a brief question?
No, a very brief one.
Right.
I didn't believe that I could find a question, and the question is simply, what are you going to do about slavery? The descendants of you touched it. I just would like to hear an answer to that.
That's an excellent question. There has been litigation pending in the United States for 10 years brought by descendants of slaves seeking damages from the United States government and from a score or more companies that historically promoted slavery in the United States. That litigation has got nowhere. Nowhere. The courts have said it's not defined, it's a political question, better addressed by Congress. There has been no interest in the United States. Or to put it another way, the idea of compensating for slavery lacks the political bipartisanship, the political groundswell of support in the United States to justify it. Now, there's been some informal apologies. I don't believe the government has formally even apologized for slavery. Maybe it has. I don't know. But I think it highly unlikely that there'll be any type of compensation program to rectify the injustices of slavery in the United States. Should there be? Hey, terrible wrong. Try figuring out how you're going to do it in a democracy. Very, very difficult.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've thought about this. You've obviously had to think about so much in that time. What is the value of a human life?
Now, that can be looked at legally. I'll respond two ways. I'll respond as a lawyer, and I'll respond as a priest. As a lawyer, the value of a human life in America is directly tied to compensation. It's directly tied to a determination of what that life achieved in the economic marketplace. That's the way it is for 200 years in America. What's the value of a bond trader's life when he falls off a ladder and dies? Well, he was making $500,000 a year, and he was 38 years old, and he would have worked until he was 62, 500,000 times whatever the number of years, and pa-pa-pa-pa, and pain and suffering, and we will give you $4,223,623. That's the lawyer. And I must say, that approach, not only the bond trader, but in the 9/11 fund, that approach is ingrained in the American character, in American history. That's the way you value lives. Economic loss plus pain and suffering. Now, when I put on my hat as a priest in 9/11, I try to tell each family member who came to see me, Mr. Feinberg, what is my husband's life worth? What is my wife's life worth? And I would say, I am not a priest or a rabbi, but all lives are the same. I am not Solomon. I cannot calculate the moral intrinsic worth of any human being. So what is a life worth? The question mark remains. I would say once again, if government's going to get in this business, it would be well advised to deal with your question by giving everybody the same amount of money and avoid these distinctions that cannot help but trigger an emotional adverse response from the very people you're trying to help. A bad answer, I think, to a very good question.
Yep.
Could I ask a question as a lawyer and as a priest? you, in terms of the Japanese internees, Could you give us an idea of the range of reactions? Because as I understand, they only got $20,000 each. Presumably there'd be some who would have said, well, that's very tokenistic, but there'd be others who would have thought, well, how can you apologise without giving us something? What sort of reactions?
Political support, basically unanimous. First of all, there were no lawsuits that could be filed. The statute of limitations had run. Most of the Japanese-American citizens relocated had died. There was no real legal cause of action that anybody could advance. So the notion of providing gratis $20,000 per family when the alternative was zero was accepted as politically and socially acceptable. Obviously, the $20,000 meant more to some families than others, but that, accompanied with the apology, was an expression by the American people that we can't rectify a past wrong, but we're sorry, and here is a gift, a token of our acknowledgement of responsibility.
Now, we have another two questions only now, if they're brief. One over here.
Thank you very much for a very enlightening talk today. My question's simply about, as an active emergency services worker, how does, for instance, a fund or compensation work in terms of, particularly I've heard problems of health, much later than the 33-month period? Some are suffering now, some died penniless without health benefits. Would that be a better way to compensate people? And in addition, what about volunteers and their role in the response?
Absolutely eligible. We paid over $1 billion to rescue workers who developed respiratory injuries after 9/11 down at the World Trade Center. They were all eligible. The problem we've run into in the United States today is that that there were thousands of rescue workers who didn't develop any physical disease until after the fund had expired. There are currently about 11,000 rescue workers litigating in the United States, not as a result of the 9/11 attacks, but after the attacks, working down in the World Trade Center pit, breathing that guck from the collapse of the towers. Since there's no 9/11 fund, they're all litigating, seeking workers' comp damages, and it's a terrible problem. Congress has been thinking about reactivating the fund, and as I've said to you, virtually that'll never happen. So, yes, we did pay quite a bit, and we would have paid these people, except they didn't get sick until after the fund had expired.
Yeah, lady over here, last question.
Hi. You mentioned problems with singling out people in a democracy for special treatment, and you also phrased what the fund was doing in terms of incredible financial generosity when the alternative might have been very little. But, the other viewpoint is that the US government was doing something financially quite advantageous to itself by excluding people from litigating by entering the fund. And also, obviously, there was a feel-good factor of being seen to be generous and addressing a crisis. So, on the balance, obviously you don't have to pick one view or the other, but on the balance, how would you say that relates to other compensation situations?
First of all, I've never been convinced that the United States government did something helpful to itself in terms of its financial exposure. I think these lawsuits that were brought against the United States and the World Trade Center on the merits never had a prayer of succeeding. So, but I think you're asking a very good question, a very good way to end this discussion today. There would have never been a 9/11 fund but for the desire of the United States to protect the airline industry, the World Trade Center, from tort litigation. You're absolutely right. One should not assume that this fund was created entirely out of compassion and generosity. There was a real, calculated reason for creating the fund. Having said that, the airlines and others could have been protected without giving $7 billion to a very select group of people. I think you have to look at the fund both ways. A reasoned decision designed to prevent the airline industry from being brought to its knees, while at the same time, patriotic fervor to demonstrate national solidarity with the victims. And I got to think, you got to look at it that way, I believe. I want to close. I want to thank for this extraordinary invitation. I want to thank Australian National University, ANU, and the faculty at ANU for bringing me here this last week. I've had a glorious time in Sydney and Canberra. I'm told there's a lot of the rest of the country that I'm not getting the chance to visit. And I hope to return sooner rather than later. And I'm grateful to all of you, and you've treated me with such admiration and welcome and gratitude. I'll be forever grateful to this visit. Thanks so much.